Not a study for the test, which is next Tuesday. So let's do lights up for a minute here. So you got your handout, extra handout last time, and I briefly sort of told you what the structure of the test is. So let me give you tips, my best guess for how to study for it. Everybody's got their own way of doing these things, but here's my tips. So on the very first section, where you're doing slide identification, I think if you try to memorize slides, that's a real problem. There are too many of them, and you'll just frustrate the hell out of yourself. So some people do make little flashcards, and you know that's cool, no problem with that. But I don't know, just memorizing all of them individually, that's a lot of work. I think it's more important to know the building than it is to know the slide. So if you really understand that building, in particular, if you can remember what it is we were talking about, what was it we were looking at, then that will help you remember that building. And that will help you remember that architect and that place and things like that. So my advice is to take your little sheets that you get every time, and you just go down there and think, whoa, St. Ignatius Chapel. Yeah, what were we talking about that one? And then sort of reposition in your head what that looked like and why that was true of it. And my experience is that if you learn them that way, you nail it. Not a problem. So that's my suggestion on how you study for that. It will, as I said last time, it'll only be those that were on your handouts and that we also looked at in class. Okay, so that's section one. Section two is multiple choice questions, 5 of them on the book, 5 of them on the class activities. I would say on the book, there are 2 things you should pay attention to. Number one is that Rasmussen has a point of view. And in this class, we've emphasized over and over, it's not like, you know, there's only one way of seeing this. And I don't expect that you always would necessarily agree with Rasmussen. Our second book, in particular, I would say half the class will not agree with her on that. That's not the point. You're supposed to understand the point of view of the book and of the author. So Rasmussen definitely has a point of view. So, for example, when he's talking about rhythm in architecture, he'll show you one example of like the Quirinale Palace in Rome, where it's incredibly rigorous, orderly. The rhythm is just bam, 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 ad infinitum. And he makes a point of, well, what does that mean and what does that do? And then he'll talk about another rhythm, like the windows at the chapel at Ronchamp, which are very irregular, very staccato. That's a very different kind of rhythm. And so what's his point of view on this? Is one of these rhythms better than another rhythm? What does he think? So that's what you ought to be looking for, his point of view. Another example, so in the section on hearing architecture, he talks about church architecture. He talks about music in church architecture. He talks about the acoustics of all of these different churches. And they have radically different acoustics. And so what is he saying? Is there a right acoustics? Is there a wrong acoustics? How does he deal with that? What's his point of view? So that's really critical. So in the book, each of those chapters, you should be trying to figure out, okay, what's his point of view here? Okay, so that's one thing to look for. The other thing is there are tons of examples in that book, and I think I mentioned to you earlier, the guy's from freaking tiny little Denmark, and he likes to use examples of buildings that are in Copenhagen or that he's familiar with there. And so many of these examples, you can look at the picture and you can get the point, and that's great, but these are not particularly renowned buildings that you need to remember the name of the building or the name of the architect or anything like that. But there are examples he uses in there that are important examples in world architecture and ones that we've often by architects we've looked at in class. And you should be collecting a little bit of, you know, thought about, well, that's what that architect stands for, that's what their values are, that's how they do work. So it's important that you make the connection between the architect's work we're looking at in class and the architect's work that he's talking about in the book. So there are a lot of architects where there are overlaps. So like we talked about Palladio and the Villa Rotunda in class, he talks about Palladio and the Villa Foscari in the book. We talked about Mies van der Rohe in class and primarily looked at the Farnsworth House. He talks about Mies van der Rohe and looks at the Tugendhat House. We talked about Le Corbusier and looked at the chapel at Ronchamp. He talks about the chapel at Ronchamp and Pessac and Unité d'Habitation and a number of Le Corbusier buildings. We talked about Borromini in class and Carlo La Quattrofontana. He talks about Borromini in the book. So where there are overlaps between architects we talked about in class, like Borromini or Frank Lloyd Wright or Le Corbusier or Palladio, these are examples you should pay particular attention to. And what is he saying about them? And then, you know, ingesting, what did we say about those people in class? So look particularly at the examples where it's an architect that we also looked at in class. Okay, if you know those two things, you know his point of view, and you are looking at those examples, man, you will nail it. I will guarantee you that all those questions are in that umbrella. Okay, so then how would you study for the questions that might be on material in class? So I told you at the very beginning, when you're taking notes and I say there are five of this, or there are six of that, or there are 12 of these, you need to really get those down. So there are several of these questions that are going to be like that. So if we talked about, you know, what are the motivations for making beautiful buildings? And we looked at one where the motivation was religion, and we looked at another where the motivation was power, and we looked at another where the motivation was grief. You know, where we have a series of things like that, that's a really great question for the test. So be very cognizant of that. You know, in other, we've done that over and over. Say, in the one on organic sources of form, and I was talking about, you know, what things in nature was this architect really being inspired by? And so in the case of Gaudí, it was like the region. And in the case of the Dipoli at the Technical University at Otaniemi, Raimi and Raila Pietila, it was the site. So just those things where I do a series, be sure you know that kind of stuff. Then a second thing to look for is sometimes they're just little factual things where I told you, take this down. Pay attention to those. So when I told you, take it down, pay attention. I may be asking for that fact again. And then the final thing is this wrap-up lecture today, this synthesis lecture. Two of the five questions are out of this lecture. And partly because it's an overview. We're looking at the whole picture. So there's a good source, this particular lecture. Be sure you're cognizant of what we're dealing with here. Okay, again, if you do those things, I think you'll be in good shape. Then on the essay questions, here are a couple of tips. Number one, please do not think this is like in high school, your English teacher told you you should start every essay. If there's a prompt, you restate the prompt at the beginning and describe what you're going to say. The test is too short. Just freaking write the stuff. Just get to the stuff. So don't do a lot of flowery essay writing things. In fact, if you want to do the whole thing in bullet points, we're fine with that. If you want to use sketches, if you want to use diagrams, we don't really care. This is essay questions, yeah, but we're not looking for any kind of formal, structured essay here. Just write what you know. And we're just interested mostly in knowing the answer to the question. So that's one thing. Another thing is you ought to be able to, on the front of one sheet of paper, there'll be the question at the top, you ought to be able to answer it on that sheet of paper if you have normal-sized handwriting. If you have big loopy handwriting, it might take you a little longer. And we're not, you know, you can flip it over and write on the back if you want to, but generally, it should be concise. You're given these questions in advance. You should have a very clear, concise answer to that question. And it ought to be able to, you know, not be so long. You really won't have time to write too much more than that. Okay, a couple of tips on that. Anybody got any questions? Got it nailed, huh? Easy breezy, not a problem. Yeah. Okay, so the question is, when I put up slides, are they going to be building exteriors, building interiors, plans? It could be any of the above. For instance, when we looked at the Villa Rotunda, we were very interested in those proportions of rooms, and that plan was really central to the discussion. So that could be a very likely thing to show up on the screen, because we really talked about it a lot. It's generally going to be images that had to do with what we were talking about in that building. So that, I mean, I'm not going to, if we didn't look at a plan or the plan wasn't, we didn't discuss it at all, then the plan's not going to show up. It's only if it really was part of what our discussion was. Okay. Good luck. And it looks like the weather's going to be fantastic, going out and looking at cool buildings, preparing for your essays. As I said before, doing it collectively, that's great. Find a couple of people from your discussion section or somebody who lives on your hall and, you know, go out and just bat ideas back and forth, brainstorm on them. It always helps you see things you might not have seen before, and I totally encourage you to do that. Okay, so last time we were talking about numbers, mathematics, and geometry as sources of form, and we outlined a number of different motivations one might have for using numbers, mathematics, and geometry. And I ask you to tell me which of those resonated more with you, or you seem to think that might be more appropriate in what inspires numbers, mathematics, and geometry in architecture. I got a lot of really, really good answers. You guys are getting very, very good at these Twitter card responses. So let me read you a few. Someone says, I think in this age that focuses on data, numbers, and technology, people now see and think in black and white and scientific terms. Things like mysticism that can't be explained are cast away as childlike. That's why I think mysticism is the most important. It reminds us that in life, things aren't just black and white. Damn, I love that one. Somebody else says, mysticism in numbers makes the most sense to me because as a Muslim, Arabic is the language of my religion and culture. Just as there is mysticism in religion, numbers also provide that transcendent quality, which is noted in the Quran. Someone else says, I like to think that mysticism is an important reason for using certain proportions and geometries. Mysticism accounts for the unexplained harmony we experience in the world all the time. And without it, life can become too structured and boring. Someone else says, the mysticism of these ratios and shapes is most fascinating. The way that a lot of these relate back to human scale reflects the fact that these buildings are an extension of ourselves. It's hard to define what is beautiful, but these ratios seem to have some tie to our inner sense of beauty. Then some people thought prestige was more interesting. For example, someone says, I think many people throughout history have used ornate, complex, and decorative structures to show prestige and power. But pure geometric shapes are a much more potent way to show prestige. The Washington Monument sticks out to me as an example. It has such a strong symbolic power for such a purely simple shape. Other people thought the fact that it made structural sense was important. Someone says, I think it's important that it makes structural sense because it conserves materials. It creates a simple plan to allow a simple plan to follow, and that is reflected in how the viewer feels. It's practical, smart, and efficient. Someone else says, I think that mysticism is one of the most interesting elements when we study buildings of antiquity. However, in today's society, I think that using geometry and mathematics should be based on what is structurally most sensible. Some people thought the sort of intellectual puzzles was cool. Somebody says, I find the puzzling nature of geometric forms to be the most important because we are in a century that values great intellect over mysticism. A building that puzzles and challenges our perception has a humanizing quality. Along the same line, somebody says, as humans, our minds are always working. They never turn off. While we constantly look for any kind of intellectual stimulation in useless iPhone apps, we can also find natural neurological stimulation in the world around us. As we are drawn to the puzzles and patterns of nature, so we are also drawn to these intellectual challenges in buildings, more so than anything else. And finally, some people found the iconic quality most important. For example, someone says, the iconic nature of basic geometric shapes is the strongest quality of mathematically based architecture. We are nurtured to respond to basic geometric forms. They catch our eye. Damn, those are good. I mean, each one of those is just really thoughtfully considered. I'm blown away. So today, we're looking at a synthesis of form. This is the last lecture we'll have on form in architecture. And all of this has been about how can we really understand the visual side of architecture. And we're going to shift gears after the test and be looking at a range of other things. But as a wrap-up here, I want to make the point that although we've been looking at specific ways of analyzing form, in the end, it's about a building being strong in form in general, in a larger sense, in a complete sense. So today we're going to look at three buildings and just look at them, analyzing them in terms of form, in a holistic way. How do they use this element? How do they use that element? How do they become a powerful, visually stimulating building by using a number of the things that we've talked about over the last couple of weeks? So I'm going to very explicitly use the content from several of the previous lectures to analyze these three buildings in some depth. The first of these, and all of these are relatively contemporary buildings. They're buildings basically of our own age, but all over the world. One example in the United States, one example in Europe, one example in Japan, and in part to make this point of how these things are just universal. They are transcendent. They're about any kind of architecture in any culture, these principles about form. So the first building I want us to look at is St. Ignatius Chapel. This is at University of Seattle in Seattle, Washington. The architect is Stephen Hall, and it was completed in 1998. This is a Catholic university. University of Seattle doesn't sound like it's a religious university, but it's a very, very Catholic university, relatively small university, right near the center of downtown Seattle. And Stephen Hall happened to have been from Seattle. He grew up in Seattle. His practice was in New York, but as a relatively young architect, he was very, very excited about the possibility of getting this commission back in his own hometown. Stephen Hall is a major, major architect at this point, but this was one of his very earliest commissions. So it was a competition, and he was selected on the basis of that competition, and then he designed the building from there. And I was fortunate to be able to walk around the building with the guy who was the client on this, a priest, a very, very devout priest there, who had, together with Stephen Hall, been very much involved in making this tiny little chapel. Now, it's on a college campus. And because it's a Catholic school, the chapel is super important to this school. But it's a tiny building. The truth is, you don't get hordes of college students attending services these days. Yeah, that sounds familiar. I mean, it just doesn't happen. So although it's a Catholic university and they want the chapel to be a very prominent part of their campus, they don't want people in an empty, you know, sanctuary. So it's a small building, but with a big job, with a lot of importance. So they located at the end of a long axis. At one end of this axis is the Student Union, which is a big building and very active and lively. And at the other end of this axis is a tiny, tiny little chapel. But it has to be big in significance in order to compensate for the fact that it's a relatively small building. So on the left, we're seeing down that long axis, and at the end of it is the chapel. It also was on a site that was a tiny little rectangular site, so it completely fills the site. And it's a rectangle in plan reflecting that site. So this is the kind of approach to it in the front door in the slide on the right, and it completely fills this site. Okay, let's talk about this in terms of several of the elements of form. Number one, just from those initial things, you can see it is significantly about shape. There are these big, strong shapes in the building. And they call your attention to it, and they give the building an importance that maybe a slightly more timid or more ordinary building wouldn't have. So he uses shape as a way of giving distinction to the building. It also has amazing space. Once you're inside it, all of those volumes and, you know, different shapes get reflected then in space that's all interlocking on the inside, but very interesting and very intricate and very evocative space once you get on the inside. So very memorable place on the inside. Another quality that's very powerful here is light. And the light comes in, there's this sort of light and darkness, and sometimes the light comes from high, and sometimes it comes from low, and it seeps in and edges, and it comes from odd places, and sometimes it's reflected soft light, and sometimes it's direct light, but it's very, very strong use of light. It also uses color quite effectively, and kind of in an interesting way. If you see on the slide on the right, there's some blue glass that's using the light and the color like traditional stained glass would. But you also see around that baffle, there's a kind of yellow light, very soft, very subtle yellow light. And what happens is there's actually a very big window behind that baffle. And then the back of the baffle is painted bright, bright yellow. And the light reflects off of the back of the baffle and then just gives this kind of glow of yellow onto the wall. So on the right, we're seeing the window shining onto the bright yellow. On the left, we're seeing how that yellow just gives a kind of soft glow of yellow behind the baffle. So it's clever use of shape and of space and of light and of color. Also has a very careful use of texture. All of the walls are made out of plaster, but instead of troweling on the plaster really smooth, they used a trowel with teeth in it so that you get this very subtle texture of the plaster. And you can see the stroke of the craftsman's hand as they were making the plaster. The glass in the windows, Seattle is famous for glass works, and they had art glass in it that has a texture in the glass. So you see the light combining not just with the color, but also combining with the texture as well. There you can see on the slide on the left, this textured glass. So we could go through all the elements of form, but certainly shape, space, light, color, texture, all of these things are very strong in the building. And they're making it a more iconic building on the campus because it's tiny, but it needs to have a big position on the campus. Okay, so that's central visual form that we talked about in that first lecture in this segment. And then we were talking also about kind of intellectual sources of form. And this building is super entrenched in intellectual sources of form. It's a freaking college campus. It's a Jesuit campus. Jesuits, that's a segment within Catholicism that is really about intellectual pursuit. They're fantastic educators. There are many Jesuit colleges, and this is one of them. So Stephen Hall, in trying to figure out what would inspire this building, he went back to what is Jesuit intellectual philosophy about. And he went back to the founder of Jesuit segment, and it's a guy named St. Ignatius of Loyola. So St. Ignatius Chapel is named after him. And St. Ignatius of Loyola wrote a lot, and he was quite a philosopher. Stephen Hall went back and read St. Ignatius. And St. Ignatius had this philosophy about life and about religion that really struck Stephen Hall. So St. Ignatius said that life is a series of consolations and desolations. Consolations and desolations. And you need to expect in your life moments of ecstasy, wonderful, amazing, great, and moments of despair and down and depressed, and that this is the normal human existence, and that we should not expect everything to be great all the time. That part of the richness of life is this consolations and desolations. And St. Ignatius compares this to the cycle of light and dark, night and day, and how boring it would be to have everything darkness all the time or everything light all the time. But it's the cycle of light and darkness that gives our life rhythm. And so the cycles of consolations and desolations are things we should accept and really enjoy in our lives. So he's making this analogy to light and dark as consolations and desolations. So Stephen Hall got the idea, well, what if the church was an experience of light and dark, and light and dark? And there was that sense of ecstasy and maybe despair, and ecstasy and despair. And as you went through the church, you had that same experience. So the sketch he did very early on the right was just making a point of some places that get this generous light and then other places that would not get this. He also was very interested in the three things that we talked about in that lecture on intellectual sources of form. He was interested in order, and there is a certain orderliness of this rectangular form, simple rectangular form. And there are moments in the chapel, as in the slide on the left, where it's just very clear, serene, calm, orderly environment. And there's something about religion that is meant to be serene and orderly. But then there also are many parts of the chapel, and you can see it in the model on the right, that is actually very complex. All of these different bits of light and light coming in different ways and these different shapes, there's a complexity that's there as well. So he's certainly interested in order, but he's also interested in complexity in contrast to the order. And then he's also interested in this notion of technique. So initially, he wanted to build the building out of this beautiful stone from Minnesota called Mankato stone. And it's a golden-colored stone, really one of the most beautiful stones naturally occurring in the United States. But, you know, reality set in, and he realized, oh, my God, I've got a budget that's really low here, and I can't afford this Mankato stone. So that dropped out of the picture. And instead, he realized, you know, I've only really got the budget to make this out of precast concrete. Whoa. That's kind of tough. It's supposed to be a chapel, but the budget is quite low, and we can only make it out of precast concrete. So he thought, well, how could we do that concrete very economically? And what they did was they precast it on the site. So the first thing they did was they went out, and there was that rectangle, and they poured a slab all over that rectangle, a big, flat slab. And then they laid down sheets of plastic, polyethylene plastic, just little bitty sheets of plastic. And then they would just take simple, like 2x6s, 2x8s, and make formwork around on that slab. in these interesting shapes. Now, that's not a lot of labor to do that. You can even make curved shapes pretty easily because you can bend the pieces of wood. So they laid out this formwork on the slab, and then they just poured a second layer of concrete on top of the plastic with this more complex exterior shape. And then they tilted it up, and that became the walls. And so normally you would build concrete walls with formwork on both sides, and you would have to pour the concrete in at the top, and you would have to make sure it got in there. Whereas this is much, much simpler. Just pour it flat, let gravity flatten it out there, make very simple formwork around the outside, and then tilt it up like that. This is normally used in really cheap warehouse buildings. It's called tilt slabs. But he figured out a clever way to do that and apply it in this chapel. So it's the technology that is inspiring the capability to make these curvilinear forms, these unusual shapes and forms. Now, there is this little bit of a problem with that technology in that when you lift it, you have to have something to grab onto. So in an industrial situation, they would just put a loop of steel cable, just plop it into the concrete, and then they'd lift it up. And if it's an industrial application, okay, that ugly, they just snip it off then. And you see this in these industrial parks where they've the pick points, they call them, where they pick it up, they just snip it off. Well, he couldn't have that raw a construction here. So what he ends up doing is making these little bitty brass plates that cover up those pick points. And there's an example of one right there. And he puts a little brass cap on top of the pick point. So you have these panels, and you can see the joints between those panels. Often a window is used as a place where the joints occur between two panels. So they're making all these panels flat. They're pulling them up. At that pick point, then they put this beautiful little tiny brass thing as a bit of ornament to talk about the technology. So it is technique that is helping to inspire the form and even make this little bit of ornament that we see in that cover for the pick point right there. Okay, so he's talking about order, he's talking about complexity, he's talking about technique. He also is very much taking these ideas of St. Ignatius and he's intellectualizing them and he's comparing them to the program and he's using that as a way of generating the building form. So he thinks light and dark, consolation, desolation. Then he thinks, let's think through everything that needs to happen in a chapel. What is the function? What are each of the parts of the chapel that we need to make just right? So he identifies that there are seven functions that need to happen in here, and each of them have a light quality that's appropriate for that function. And he, in the little drawing he did on the left, he has that wall around the outside. So he imagined it as this concrete wall. And inside that would be what he's referred to as seven bottles of light. Seven bottles of light. Each of these bottles would be a function. Each of them would have a different light quality. So the first bottle is the procession. It's when you go in the front door and you come into the church. And oh my gosh, that is just, it just says 100% procession. And the light comes in from above you and it reflects on that curved ceiling and it just draws you into the church. It is just the right light quality for the activity of procession. And then once you get inside there, there is a little room that is the narthex. And that's the second bottle of light. And that's this little room right here. And it's got a window that looks back out to the reflecting pool and all the way down that axis to the student union at the other end. And it's a rectangular room and it's a simple room. And it's got a window. The light isn't coming in from the top. It isn't dramatic. This is a place where people are just chit-chatting before the service or after the service. So it isn't spiritual particularly. It's more informal. And it's just got a window and a normal way of bringing light into the room. So the first bottle is procession. The second bottle is Narthex. The third bottle is the baptistry. And this is particularly, I think, important in this chapel because there are a lot of graduate students at this university. They often are married. They may have children while they're in school. And it turns out there just happen to be a lot of babies being birthed at this school. So that's what the chaplain is telling me. We do a lot of baptistry. So we told him from the beginning, baptistry is a big thing here. So there is the most beautiful little piece of the church that is all about baptistry. And it has this very soft light. It's coming from the side, but it's through a milky glass, this very calming, very serene, very beautiful soft light for baptistry. And that's the third bottle. The fourth bottle is the sanctuary itself and the altar. And that's where the congregation meets. And it's got little bits of light that come in from all over the place. It's not a singular light experience. It's a multiple light experience. And it's got color. You know, you're going to have music, and you're going to have procession. You know, all of these things are a little more dramatic. So the light quality is more dramatic, and it has color, and it comes in from multiple directions. And it's shaped by a certain light quality as well. Then the, what are we on, the fifth bottle of light is the communion space. And this is where they actually, you go, you don't have communion at the altar in this church. You go to a separate little room, and it's called the Reconciliation Chapel, and that's where they have the communion. And it is, it has an orange light in it, and it has a very dramatic, and the orange is meant to be like the blood of Christ. So it's got a light character, and that orange is, the light shines on it, and it bounces orange all over the room. So it's got its own light quality. And then the sixth bottle of light is the confession, and it is very somber in there, but just with light from the top, one skylight that lets light in to this very private kind of space. And then the seventh bottle of light is the choir over here. And that one has really no light. It's just a kind of closed space, acoustically reverberant, and bounces the sound back into the rest of the room. So we have seven bottles of light. We have the procession where you go in the front door. We have the narthex. We have the baptistry. We have the sanctuary. We have the communion. We have the confession. And we have the choir, and all of those then get an expression on the top of the building and in the shape of the building that brings just the right quality of light there. And I can't tell you how this chaplain is just so all over this notion. He said, I tell all my parishioners about these bottles of light. And when they understand and they appreciate the building so much more because in their head they can see all of the pieces of the worship service and all of them celebrated in the building in these consolations and desolations of light. Now, there also are many, many sources of form here in numbers, mathematics, and geometry. This little square in the center of a square reflecting pool, very clear, orderly geometry. Let's see if I got one. This front here, this is very clever. That is a horizontal golden rectangle. And then he takes a square out of the side of it for the front door. And then there's a vertical golden rectangle in the glass, just like I had you do for the golden spiral. He's subtracting that square from the golden rectangle and making other golden rectangles. He's using all of those geometric shapes and proportions very cleverly, very beautifully through the whole building, inside and outside. Even in these windows, there's circles and there's squares and there's crosses. The cross as a kind of perfect geometric form is very prominent in the building. This wonderful little table where the cross is there as a geometric form, a perfect square of the top of the table. Even here at the altar, this is very interesting that look at the legs of the table, and they're these geometric pieces, but they also are making the alpha and the omega, the beginning and the end. first and the last letter of the Greek alphabet. So that, as a biblical reference, God says, I'm the Alpha and the Omega, the beginning and the end. And that is geometricized to make the four legs of the table. So strong geometry. In the baptistry, this perfect circle, the whole bowl being a part of a sphere, then the table on the side, a perfect square, those things in juxtaposition to each other. Just as Leonardo was saying, no, these are the sacred forms that God would make the church with. So the circles and the squares that Leonardo found in the human body, and those also in the windows as well. But then there are also organic sources of form. There are these light scoops that are very gently, organically bringing the light into the space. And they're making a contrast between the geometric sources of form and the organic sources of form. There's this wonderful front door ensemble. God, this is just a beautiful tactile wood. This is a local Northwest U.S. wood. And I hope you can see on the texture there, instead of sawing it, it's actually honed. I mean, they took little chips of wood out of it so that it's got this very woody textured surface, and it emphasizes the grain in the wood. And then these openings in the wood there, those are the shape of the seed pod of this particular tree. It has a seed pod that's this long elliptical shape. So those are what make the light openings there. And then the handle that you actually grab to open the door, that is a reference to the shawl that the priest wears that goes over the shoulders, and those natural shapes of your shoulders and the drape of the cloth over it are making the shape of the entrance pull to the building. I'm just making the point here that you can look all over this building. And you can see all of these things we've been talking about, even in the light fixtures. They're made of glass. And I said Seattle's very well known for glass blowing and art glass and things like that. So all of these were made by local craftsmen there in Seattle. There's one of those light fixtures. There you can see that texture of the troweled plaster there. And then the shape of the glass is not, you know, a perfect flat rectilinear shape, but it's the shape glass is when it's molten, you know, when it finds its own shape. When you cool it, it cracks. You know, you have to work like hell to get it to be perfect. Instead, this is the more natural character of glass, that it bends and it cracks, and it, as it cools, it takes its own shape, and that's expressed in the light fixtures in the building. Handrails in this where you take communion. There actually is a branch of a tree that was put into the room to remind you of the cross that Christ hung on that came from the tree. So you get the geometry of the cross, perfect, the geometry of the tree, natural, and you make that connection in the chapel that's meant to be about the crucifixion. All in all, just, wow, an amazing building. So I have this brother who is a couple of years older than I am, and he's a hotshot lawyer in Washington. He's always kind of, I don't know, poo-pooed architecture for a while when we were younger, because I was his little brother, right? And he always had to dump on anything I was doing. But then at a certain point, he got kind of interested in architecture. I think I got him addicted. I told you I'm a pusher. I'm not just a pusher to you guys. I'm a pusher to everybody, including my freaking brother. So now he's totally hooked, okay? I got him. So he and I go on trips together. At least once a year, we'll take a long weekend and just go on a trip together. We're going to LA in November to see some buildings that are going up there. And we always are looking at architecture when we go on these trips. So we went to Seattle, and we went to St. Ignatius Chapel here, and it was on a Sunday morning. I saved it on the weekend so that it was when there would be a service there. So we got there maybe an hour before the service, and we both had flights to catch, you know, so we could sort of go to the service, then we had to go get on an airplane. And we go there, and the choir is practicing before the service. So we're inside there, and the acoustics are beautiful. Oh, my God, and the choir was so good. Oh, fantastic choir. And so we're sitting there just on one of the benches. There's not anybody there yet for the service. We're just listening to the choir. And my brother just gets like, wow, this is freaking amazing. So we actually weren't going to stay for the service to give ourselves enough time. And he said, no, we got to stay. So we stayed for that service. And I will tell you, it was an incredibly moving service. That the people at that Mass were totally into the Mass. And that building helped them have a better Mass. And I told my brother, you know, shall we go on? And he said, I can't leave. This is my hard-boiled lawyer brother. I can't leave. This is too beautiful. This service is beautiful. This choir is beautiful. The music is beautiful. The light is beautiful. It was a picture-perfect day when we were there. It's too beautiful. I can't leave here. And so we stayed and then absolutely rushed and, you know, tried to get to our airplanes on time. But, yeah, it's all of these things that are making that such a beautiful place. Okay, let's do building number two. This one is an art museum in Kanazawa, Japan. It's the Museum of Contemporary Art of the 21st Century, and the architect is Kazuo Sejima. Kazuo Sejima is one of the most renowned women architects in the world. She and her partner are a firm called Sana, this is one of their most renowned buildings. They've now done several buildings in the United States as well, but most of their work is in Japan. So this one is, Kanazawa is a medium-sized city on the west coast of Japan, kind of facing Asia. It's in a very important location. It's right next to one of the most beautiful Japanese gardens. There are three most renowned Japanese gardens in Japan, and one of them is here in Kanazawa and immediately next door to the museum. Also one of the very most historic forts or citadels, castles, is also immediately adjacent to the site. So it's in a very, very important historic district in Kanazawa. But it is meant to be a museum of the art of the 21st century. So as you might be seeing these things that were done in the 15th, 16th, 17th, 18th century, you're also seeing now what are we doing in the 21st century in this art museum. So very, very powerful sources of form here. It's a garden where the building is located. On one side of it is the bigger garden, this famous Japanese garden. And then over here would be the great castle. But you come and go to this site from all different directions. It's not like there's a front and a back. And so the decision was made to make the museum a circle like that and have it sit in the larger garden. And people could come from every direction and they could enter the building all over. And it's a very, very unusual situation in terms of the way the building is administered in that you can come into the lobby, all of this space between the rectangular boxes, most of that is lobby. So you can, a person in the public can just come in and walk through the building. You can come from that path and walk along here and up here and go out that path without paying admission or anything like that. You can come in here and walk down like that and out here without paying admission. And so you can get a glimpse of the museum without actually paying admission and going into the museum. Very interesting attitude toward the public and the art. And then the art itself is contained in all of these individual galleries within the museum. And then you see the building as kind of an extension of the garden. There's the garden becomes the kind of big circular base of the building. And then out of that, you see the individual galleries popping up in different proportions and so on within it. So it is very powerful in terms of geometric sources of form. Yes, I mean, Palladio, eat your heart out, Palladio. perfect circles. All of the squares within here, many of the galleries are squares at various different scales, big, medium, little, sometimes circular galleries, many times golden rectangles for galleries like this, sometimes a square intersecting with a square. So very, very strong geometries in the overall shape of the building, but also in the individual pieces of the gallery. And yet there also is this organic sources of form in, for one thing, just the looseness of the way these geometries are put together, not on axes, not straightened out in a line, but also very, very organic in the way it meets the garden, and that this big circular form is then laced in these vines that then just let the garden grow right into the building. And the shape they take is just the shape that vines take as they grow up a catenary. And it's a very organic kind of shape as well. And then that's covered with these morning glories. And so in the morning, they bloom, and they're beautiful, and they're lush. And then toward the end of the day, they all close down, and it becomes... So there's this kind of cycle of the day and of nature and light that's exemplified in the growing wall of the building itself. Now, tons and tons of material here for the elements of form. Yes, it's got beautiful texture, the texture of all of those growing things. Very powerful in terms of light. The light comes through those vines, and then there is a perfectly smooth circular glass volume here, so that you get the texture of the vines, which is very rough, and the texture of the glass, which is very smooth. And then you see the light coming through it and making reflections and shades and shadow. My God, this little crevice between is just stunningly beautiful. And then when you're inside, you're seeing the reflections, and you're seeing the light, and you're seeing the beautiful, I mean, light through green leaves is really beautiful. And you get the combination of the texture and the light and the color of the green, all of those things working together to make these beautiful spaces all the way around the building. And the sense of space is really great. It's this loose kind of juxtaposition of curves and rectilinear that's making this very distinctive space, combined with the light quality of those spaces. Like I said, this is public realm, so people are just coming in and having their coffee or eating their lunch, just enjoying this as public space. And there's a real kind of nice life. Sometimes there are little performances here. Sometimes it's a whole group of little school children that are having their lunch out in these spaces. But they're partly garden and they're partly museum, and they're just kind of in between. But space is another very important element of form here. The light sometimes is completely different than that light in the public space. This light in the galleries is super controlled. Very, very, the light is all reflected and soft and introduced at the top of the room, kind of luminous light in the whole room, so that the art itself begins to be the focus. And it's all beautifully, beautifully lit. It's natural light, but it's coming in at the top and through several layers of milky glass that takes the ultraviolet light out, and softens the light, and makes it just a good general light inside the room. But then when the cloud goes behind a shadow, the sun goes behind a cloud and creates a shadow, then in the whole room it just softens the light a little bit. And you feel the natural cycles outside, but with that luminous light. Okay, so mathematical sources of form, organic sources of form, order, complexity. There also are other kind of intellectual things in this building. There are some built-in pieces of art that are very, very intellectual pieces of art. This one is a swimming pool that is just integrated into one of the courtyards. And when you're up here, you're looking down and you're seeing, oh my God, there are people in that swimming pool, staying there for hours and hours, And then when you actually go in the museum and you go down, you realize you can walk in there and it's just a little layer of water. So it's these perceptions about depth and about reflection and about, you know, space, all those things. Or this was a collaboration between the architects and an artist who did that installation in the museum. There are many other really interesting, there's a James Turrell in this museum, as we have a James Turrell in the Student Activity Center, a sky space, again, very intellectual piece that's an integration between the art and the architecture. So again, a really powerful building that you can understand its strong form in terms of geometries, in terms of organic, in terms of the elements of form, all of them contributing to making a really powerful building. The third and final building I want us to look at is, of the last 20 years or so, I would say this is one of the most powerful buildings that's been built. And this is one that people come from all over the world to see this building and hardly ever walk away neutral. You're moved by this building. It's the Jewish Museum in Berlin, and it was completed in 1999. It took the Germans from the end of World War II in 1945 until 1999 to figure out how to deal with their problem with the horrible things they did to Jews in the Holocaust. So there had been talk for a very long time about making some kind of museum that would try to deal with the issue of what happened in the Holocaust. And finally, in 1999, they opened this museum, and it was a very difficult thing to do. But when they started the project in the early 1990s, one of the first things they did was have a competition to select the architect. And they had five architects they selected to be in the competition. And most of them were extremely well-known architects. But one of them was a guy who, he had a little bit of reputation, but he really had never built anything. He did these incredible drawings. And he actually had been trained as a musician to begin with. And he had a career, a pretty good career as a musician. And then he started doing these drawings that he thought were inspired by music. And he got kind of well-known as this guy who did drawings that he called architecture, that were inspired by music. So he had something of a reputation, but he hadn't really built buildings. But he was included in this list of five because he was Jewish and because his family were Holocaust survivors. So he had been born in 1946 in Poland. 80% of his family had been killed in the Holocaust. Very few of them survived. His mother and his father were survivors. He was born in 1946. They immediately after that moved to Israel. They lived in Israel for, I don't know, 5 or 6 years, and then they moved to the United States. So Danny Liebskind grew up in the United States, but he was very much Jewish heritage, and he was very much a victim. His family were victims of the Holocaust. So in some ways, he was put on that list because there was this emotional connection through his family. And then the submission that he made, which is what you see in the slide on the left, that's one of the drawings from the competition, was just so powerful that he got the commission, even though he didn't know much about how to make a building. And that was part of what got to be a problem as well. But eventually the building did get built, and it got occupied, and it's a very, very powerful building. So it was actually an addition to an existing building. So there's an existing building right here, and these are the competition drawings of the building coming out from it. This is all part of the new building. This is the old building. That's the one that was there. It was a 19th century, very normal Berlin building of the 19th century, handsome, but nothing to write home about. But interestingly enough, for most people, they made that like, okay, well, that's the back door, and that's the
place where the administration is or something like that. And then they built a real proper museum next to it. But Danny Lipscomb took the opposite approach, and he made the front door of the museum the front door of the old building. So you just come in off the street in a normal way, and you enter this completely normal Berlin building. Nothing special about it at all. And part of that was to set you up emotionally for the kind of roller coaster he wanted to take you on. So this is the existing building right here. That's the ground floor plan. You'd go in the front door here, and you sort of have the, where you buy your tickets and stuff like that. And then you immediately go downstairs right there. And when you go downstairs, you get in this tunnel space, this underground space like that. And whoa, it's crazy down there. There are two big axes. This is the axis of exile, and that's the axis of Holocaust. It's a big X shape there. You start along here, and imagine yourself walking along here, and it's just, it's so confusing. It's like a maze. All these things intersecting with it, they're all dead ends. So you're constantly going and finding a dead end and going back, finding a dead end, going back, finding a dead end, going back. What you really want to do is go over here to the main stair that takes you up to the galleries. But you spend a lot of time just looking at dead ends and frustrating, maze of corridors when you're in that basement down there. And there's no light, and there's no point of orientation. You're very, very displaced and confused. And that's the point. He's telling you in form the message of the museum about the diaspora of the Jewish people, about the displacement, constant displacement of the Jewish people, about the dislocation they felt, about the inability to put down roots and find a place to stay. This wasn't just in the Holocaust, but persecution over centuries of Jewish ghettos being set up. And then, oh no, you can't be in that part of town anymore, and they're moved somewhere else, or they're exiled. So the building itself is giving that sense of constant displacement and frustration and confusion, just in the way you experience it moving through it. So you would, if you eventually find the stair over here, you come up that stair and you're there on the second floor, and then it's a very linear gallery, but always twisting and turning and disorienting again. And eventually you get up to the third floor where there are more galleries. I'm certain, I've been there three times, I'm sure there are pieces of this building I've totally missed, because there is no systematic way to go through this museum. You go through most museums and start here, you have a logical path and you finish there. And intentionally, this one is not that. You just kind of find your way. You just have to. It's just not a linear experience at all. So that's what the whole composition is like, the existing building here. You go downstairs, then this is that building we've been seeing. This is a piece we'll call the garden. They call the garden right there. And then the Holocaust Tower right there that we'll look at as well. So let's just think elements of form. Okay, color, ooh, dark, gray, depressing color. And it's really dour. It's made of zinc, which weathers to this dark gray, kind of a mottled dark gray. Turns out that a lot of the concentration camps where the Holocaust horrors occurred were in old industrial buildings that were made out of metal that was a lot like this. And they were extremely, if you've been to any of those concentration camps, Auschwitz or any of them, they're very dull, dark, industrial environments. So the building is made out of these dull, dark, industrial materials. In terms of shape, there are constantly these really erratic, slicing, violent cuts into the building. And the shapes are these slashes that go across the building in a very aggressive kind of way. there is this garden, is what they call it. Most people wouldn't think of this as a garden, but it's made up of these concrete piers. And there are 7 piers by 7 piers, and it's a perfect square. And this is, of course, numbers, mathematics, geometry playing into the design. It's actually 7 piers by 7 piers. 7 is a sacred number in the Jewish religion. Their sacred day is Sabbath, which is the 7th day. So 7 is a very important number. 7 times 7 is 49. These 49 piers are all filled with dirt, and then they have an oak tree growing out of the top of it. For 48 of the 49 piers, the soil comes from Berlin. For the 49th pier, the one in the very center, the soil comes from Israel. And this is to commemorate the fact that Israel was founded in 1948. So 48 of those piers have one characteristic. The 49th one is actually the soil from Israel. So the numbers, which in Jewish religion, numbers are very, very important. And that becomes a part of the making of the building. The garden is this crazy place. It's got these concrete piers, and then the space in between them is this maze. So you walk out there, and it's about, I don't know, just a little wider than my shoulders. You can just barely walk through there. You can't pass anybody walking through there because it's too narrow. You never know if somebody's coming the opposite direction because you can't see. So you're constantly, walking into someone. And that's that displacement, that sense of, I'm not in control, I can't orient myself, I'm helpless, in this kind of maze-like environment there. The light is coming from the top, it's quite dim down here, but you're seeing that there is sort of light at the top, but you can't get to it, and it's got the trees covering that light. Likewise, these shapes and geometries and forms and experiences are giving emotional content and intellectual content about the Jewish experience in Germany over centuries, and in particular in the Holocaust. The rhythms of the building, not these soothing, calm, regular rhythms, but rhythms that are quite violent. The line in the building is never a sensuous, soft, smooth line, but always aggressive, sharp, tense lines in the building. The corners are eaten away. The one stable part of a building where you expect it to really root itself into the ground, that becomes slashed away and not stable. Then as you move into the building, we begin to see these long, long corridors on that basement level, and you just walk and walk and walk. And it is not—it's not pleasant. It's not a beautiful museum at that level at all. Very meaningful, very intellectually strong, but not soothing or beautiful. And then, for a moment, there will be a little turn off to a corridor here, and there will be a really beautiful space, warm wood, nice light, and that's the place where you go to check your lineage or your heritage. So if you're Jewish, they have very, very good archives and records of Jewish families, in particular in Europe. So if your family came from Europe, you can go there and you can research and find out where the roots of your family might have been. And that place is warm and soft and rich and comforting, where you're in the presence of your family. Then when you finally find your way over to that staircase to take you up into the serious part of the museum, it's a long, skinny stair that goes from the basement to the first floor, to the second floor, to the third floor, just one continuous stair going up. And the structural system, which actually is a sensible structural system, it's carrying the lateral loads for the entire building, so it needs diagonals, but it's just this crashing through of beams that are tying the building together, but giving, just like on the outside, this sense of chaos and confusion and displacement and disorientation. So as you're moving up that long, skinny stairwell, Then when you reach the very top of the stairwell, it actually just is a stairwell into a blank wall. Okay, so you finally found your way here? Yeah. What is it? It's a blank wall. There's nowhere here. There's no destination. And again, the form is giving you a very potent intellectual message about the Jewish experience in Germany. So then you get to the gallery spaces. And so this was a very interesting situation. They got the whole museum finished, but it was so controversial what the exhibits would be. And they had committees, and they had input, and they had scholars, and they had experts, and you know, they fought, and they could not decide on content. And so when the building got finished, there were no exhibits to go in it yet. They still were years away from resolving what the exhibits would be. So the building sat empty for a little bit, and then the word began to get out what the inside of that building looked like and felt like. And people wanted to see it. So they actually opened the museum. You had to make an appointment to go see it. But you could make an appointment, pay your small fortune to go see the building empty. So I did that. I was actually there with my kids. So I said, okay, we're going to go to this museum, and it's not going to have anything in it, okay? So we're just going, and they were like, yeah, right, Larry. Ain't going to happen. We're not going to the museum. So they didn't go with me. They missed out big time. So they went to another museum, and I went there and paid my $40 or something, outrageous amount of money, to go in there and see it empty. And that's what it looked like, empty. And the day I was there, there was a dance troupe from Hungary who was doing a dance in this museum just because they felt like it was an inspiring space. And honestly, it was incredibly powerful. It told you something. There was content in just the way the inside looked, this disorienting, very chaotic kind of feeling of the interior. Then eventually they did move exhibits in, and often the exhibits work with the building very well to reinforce the content of the exhibits. And then sometimes, honestly, the exhibits just overwhelm the building, and you don't get the strength of that building that was there originally. But it's still an incredibly powerful museum. Now, there are a couple of places where they actually did not put normal exhibits. This is called the Memory Void, and they just left it open, except there is an exhibit on the floor. And that exhibit on the floor is done by an artist named Manish Kadishman. And so you actually are supposed to walk from here over to there. That's the path. And so you start to walk off there, but then the floor is covered with all these metal plates. And these metal plates have faces that seem to be screaming. And when you walk on them, the metal grates against the metal, and it has a huge reverberation in that space, and the sounds are just awful and grating, and it's like they're screaming, and it's just, and you go back, you just can't walk across there. And then somebody will try again, and they'll, oh, can't do it, and they walk back again. So the route you're supposed to go is there, but you just can't go because the sound is too frightening. But again, in the form of the building, the message is very powerful. And then the other place where there's no exhibit material is the Holocaust Tower, which is right there, which is just a room where they let you in the door one at a time, or they might let two of you in there. But mostly they let you in one person, and you go inside there, and you just stay there, and it's just a cell. And it's all concrete, and then it's black at the top, and there's just a tiny little light in there, and it's just freaking claustrophobic and scary, and that's what you're meant to experience. What is it like to be trapped? What is it like to be alone? What is it like to be taken away from your family and the people that you came with? And that's the exhibit. So all in all, an absolutely phenomenal, powerful example of form doing all these things. Very quick. No, I tell you what. We'll just give it a miss on the Twitter card question, and we wouldn't be able to read them next time anyway. So just see you Tuesday for the test.